The Volume.
Boxing with Chris Mannix is presented by FanDuel Sportsbook. There's no better place to bet the action than on FanDuel Sportsbook during the football season. I bet on FanDuel as often and as comfortably as I possibly can. It is America's number one sportsbook. It's easy to use. It's safe and secure. There are fast payouts in as quick as 2 hours. So many bet types. Same game parlay bets, live betting, player props, futures, and so much more. If you are new, just download the FanDuel Sportsbook app to get started right now. Sign up with the promo code BOXING so they know I sent you.
This is Boxing with Chris Mannix.
Oh, somebody punch him in the face.
Anthony Joshua is a composed and ferocious finisher. Watch this.
Andy Ruiz is the heavyweight champion.
Hosted by SI's Chris Mannix.
That was my moment.
Now with interviews, analysis, and everything going on in the world of boxing.
When you have talent, you are given another chance.
Here's Chris Mannix.
All right, welcome back to another episode of Boxing with Chris Mannix, part of the Volume Sports Podcast Network. Got a great show lined up for you this week. Sergio Mora, he's back. Former junior middleweight champion, DAZN broadcaster. We run through all the news of the week on this podcast. A little bit later, Darren Williams, the three-time NBA All-Star. He's now a professional boxer. He takes on Frank Gore this weekend in Florida. I talked to Darren about that transition and what he hopes to get out of boxing. As always, best way to support this podcast, get over to Apple Podcasts, post a comment, leave a rating. It's simple, it's easy, it's free. It's the best way to make sure that we keep doing this podcast week after week. That's it. All right, on to the show. All right. Are you capable of following simple instructions?
Well, if I go by your text messages, I ask you, where are you? You just write two.
No, I didn't.
Said, on the second floor? No. And then you write 14. 14 what? And then you tell
That's
me
That's not what
number.
I did at all. That is a complete fabrication. You said you got beer up here. I said, no, I'll get some. Give me two. Two, as most human beings know, means 2 minutes. I already given you the room number like 5 minutes ago. This is another continuation because you got into your Uber and didn't know where you were going.
I didn't. I wanted a nicer Marriott. See, I'm invested in Marriott, Mannix. I got Bonvoy points. So I want to use my rewards and I want a better Marriott. Grand Hyatt.
You telling me that you did download the Bonvoy app was the highlight of my day yesterday. All right, he is Sergio Mora, former junior middleweight champion, DAZN broadcaster. We are in San Antonio. We'll both be calling the Gilberto Ramirez Yaneski Gonzalez fight on Saturday night. That is at the AT&T Center where the San Antonio Spurs play their game. Sergio, I want to talk about that fight, but let's first kind of look back at what we now know about the lightweight division. For the last month, we have seen most of the top lightweights in action. You had Devin Haney in action. You had Vasily Lomachenko in action. You had Gervonta Davis in action. On the outskirts, you've got Ryan Garcia waiting to come back early next year. Based on what you saw over the last month, which included, George Kambosos coming up.
About to scold you for that one.
I know. George Kambosos, maybe the upset of the year, knocking off Teofimo Lopez. As you look at the lightweight division now, who do you see as the top dog?
The man that you forgot, George Kambosos Jr. That's the man. When you beat the man, you become the man in this sport. And right now, George Kambosos is not only on a world tour, but the man down under is on top of the lightweight division. And, you know, all the names you just mentioned, as far as Devin Haney, he had a damn good performance against a former champion and a hungry young fighter in Jojo Diaz. Tank Davis, even though he struggled, we've seen him vulnerable. So we know what he can do when he finally gets hit and backed up. So that was exciting to watch as well. Ryan Garcia missing in action, but when he comes back, he's been, you know, he proved it before that he can come back with back-to-back first-round knockouts, get up from the canvas like Luke Campbell. So you got to believe in what he says. When he says something, he's going to come back and do it. So it's just an exciting time, but I have Kambosos number one. Numero uno, Mannix.
Doesn't make any sense, though, because Kambosos.
Oh, and Lomachenko. Lomachenko looked like he didn't lose a step. He didn't lose a step. He looked like the punishing ballerina from Ukraine that he always is, beating the hell out of people from angles. And Comey was no joke. Comey's a strong fighter. You know, I watched that fight at the StubHub or Dignity Center, whatever it's called, in Carson. on a television, and I was just so impressed. Everyone around the bar, because we're there watch Donaire, but everyone around the bar was just mesmerized with Lomachenko, the footwork, because you're not used to seeing that type of footwork. So I was one of them, and I was just in awe that he's doing this in his early 30s, and he's still a top dog,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, he's the top dog at lightweight. Just because you win one fight and collect all the titles doesn't make you the man in the division. By your logic, Alexander Usyk is the man in heavyweight. Do you believe that?
No.
He's got... Okay, no. Then what's the difference?
You know, that's a good point. Maybe it's just the fact that he collected all the belts. Kambosos collected all the belts. Not a unification, not two belts. The ring, the lineal championship. The way he did it in the hometown of Teofimo Lopez at Madison
Square
impressive.
Garden.
I mean, everything was just there. It was aligned. It was a storybook victory. That's why he's number one. Look, in this sport, one punch can change your life in this sport. That's what makes it so beautiful. The fact that you can lose everything in one night and you can gain it back in one more fight.
I don't disagree with any of that.
You can't do that in basketball.
No.
You can't do it in football. You can't do it in no other
football,
sport.
Football, you can kind of do it. Well, I mean, win a Super Bowl, you change everything. But I don't disagree that it was a magical moment for George Kambosos, and he should cash in on that. But I watched Lomachenko, not just this last fight, but his previous fight against Nakatani, and every fight prior to the Teofimo Lopez fight, and he was brilliant. He was arguably, for the last few years, the top pound-for-pound guy in the sport. He has rebounded from his only loss at lightweight and won two straight. He beat up on a very good fighter, like you said, in Richard Comey. And if you were going to match Lomachenko against George Kambosos tomorrow, I mean, you and I both know we'd both pick Lomachenko to win that fight. Like, and by that standard, that's why I put Lomachenko at number one.
It would be a good fight because Kambosos knows how to follow a game plan and he knows how to cut the distance. That's probably his best asset, the fact that he knows how to close the distance really well. You know,
he's an excellent fighter.
But he knows how to do it in a sneaky... Timing is probably his best asset. Timing and cutting distance. But Lomachenko is the smaller lightweight, so he's gonna have to cut that distance.
On our show earlier this week. But like, Comey's a big lightweight, right? Comey's a big guy. Lomachenko didn't look that small against him. You put Lomachenko and Kambosos in the ring. Yeah, Kambosos might have a couple inches on him height wise, but physically, like, Lomachenko's the thicker guy in a matchup like that.
No, he fills out nicely. You can see that he's been working on his shoulders. He has that man strength. He's in excellent shape. He's just a perfect athlete. But the height is going to be the difference. The reach will be the difference. And then, you know, getting in and out, he knows how to get in and out like an expert, Loma does. But Kambosos, that's how he beat Teofimo, and he did it with flying colors. So I think he can bring that, the motivation and the momentum that he has from this fight, into a fight with Lomachenko and pass the test.
Hey, look, I'd like to see Kambosos against any of these top guys. We've talked about this on previous podcasts. I think Devin Haney is the most likely next opponent because I think, A, Haney will eagerly go to Australia, and B, I think the package that George Kambosos can get for a fight series that includes Devin Haney is going to be the most significant of the bunch. Last weekend, we saw Dimitri Bivol in action. What the hell has happened to Dimitri Bivol? Like, Dimitri Bivol, for like 3 or 4 years, looked like a Russian Gennady Golovkin. When he was fighting on HBO, he was beating guys up. He was piecing together quality win after quality win. Even one of his first fights with Matchroom was a high-level win over Joe Smith, where he dominated Smith really from start to finish. These last couple of years, not only has Bivol been inactive, but he has been uninspiring out there, Sergio. He has been dull in the ring. His fight against Umar Salanov, that was like watching paint dry. Like, it was just painful. It looked to me, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, it looked to me there were multiple times that Bivol could have stepped on the gas and gotten Umar out of there. He didn't do it. He settled for another lackluster decision. I'm just watching him like, what happened to the guy? What happened to the guy I saw steamrolling fighters? It's not like these opponents have gotten decidedly better. Like, he went the distance with Lennon Castillo. He went the distance with Craig Richards. Now Salanov. Like, what has happened to Dimitri Bivol?
I'll take it back to that Joe Smith fight. You remember what happened in that 12th round? He got rocked. He got chin checked. He got hurt. Bivol was shook in that fight, in that last round. In the fight, he was dominating. So I think that maybe, you know, rocked him a little bit where he doesn't want to get shook up like that again.
You think that one punch has something to do with
it? Oh, well, I'm just saying. I'm guessing. That's what I'm thinking. I'm trying to think why he became cautious, because he's a puncher. Usually boxers like that, like myself, for instance, I went my entire career going the distance because I didn't have pop. I wasn't born with that eraser, that magic eraser. Bivol is born with brains, intelligence, knowing how to follow a game plan, the amateur background, and the power and the size. So I just think power took a back step to him being comfortable cruising into a decision, putting it in cruise control, which is not going to get him the big money and the big fights, but he doesn't care. And you know what? Whenever it comes to fighters like that, like Demetrius Andrade's another one of those guys. Rigondeaux was like that for a long time. They don't care. They're champions. They're making excellent money, and they're on top of their division. And certain guys don't have that kind of character to want more than just that.
He has become one of the most irrelevant world champions that are out there. He really has. Because for a time, it was like he was this avoided guy, kind of a boogeyman in the division. Now, and we'll get to this later, you've got fighters like Gilberto Ramirez, a former 168-pound champion who's got a pretty big name, fighting at 175, fighting in a fan-friendly style, raising his hand, jumping up and down, and saying, I want to fight Dmitry Bivol. Instead, Bivol's over in Russia, fighting in front of a pretty small crowd. I watched that fight. Didn't look like there was a big crowd in that building that night. Fighting a guy in Solanov that's okay. He's fine, whatever. An okay fighter. And not showing any interest in fighting a Ramirez. Now, he did call for a unification fight against Artur Beterbiev. That's a fight I'd sign up for. But Bivol, to me, he's got to get a real fight next, sooner rather than later. These pointless fights are just wastes of time for a world champion, in my mind anyway.
If he was taking care of business the way Golovkin was taking care of business against, you know, fighters that were pretty much no-namers as well, you know, it's the way he was knocking them out that was turning heads. What, 20 straight knockouts or whatever it was? That's what people care about. It doesn't, I mean, yeah, we care who you're knocking out as well. But when he's knocking out former champions and devastating body shots like he did in Macklin, and that one-punch knockout of Nobu Ishida, I mean, that's what you remember. That's all that really matters. And Dmitry Bivol, he was doing that. And, you know, once you start stepping up your competition, the knockout ratio is going to diminish, but not like it's diminished for Bivol. He hasn't had a knockout in, what, 2 years, 3 years?
I can't, off the top of my head, I'm not sure, but it was before the Smith fight, probably. I don't know. Like, it's been a while.
So it's been a while, but it's been a handful of fights that he hasn't been able to do.
Castillo went the distance, Richards, and now this. It's been a few years.
It's been five fights around there, 3 years, and that right there, considering you were steamrolling everybody, that's a cause for concern, because it has nothing to do with his power. It has everything to do with the way he's thinking about executing his strategy.
That's interesting. You really think the Joe Smith fight had that kind of impact? Because I know what you're talking about. I think it was the 11th round.
It was 11th or 12th.
He got 11th
rocked before bad.
He was, yeah,
in
he
a fight that he was
and
easily
kind
winning.
Kind of stumbled back to the corner there a little bit. The first time I've seen him rock like that.
If he never got hurt in the amateurs, I can see how that can definitely have a psychological effect on him, because anytime you get rocked like that, you're not accustomed to it. You're like, whoa, what was that? I never want to go back there again. Oh my God. And then you start fighting a little bit more cautious. It takes away from you as a fighter. A lot of things take away from you as a fighter and as a beast. That's one of them.
Golden Boy made him, from what I understand, $1 million offer to fight Gilberto Ramirez. He needs to take it. If he can't get Beterbiev in his next fight, he needs to be back in the U.S. fighting Ramirez and trying to build any kind of fan base, build any kind of legacy at this point, because we don't need another meaningless fight for Ramirez. You mentioned that you were ringside watching the Donaire fight. I love Nonito Donaire. 39 years old and still going strong. He knocks out Raymar Caballo. That's after he knocked out another opponent to win a title a few months earlier in the spring. He's won four of his last five fights fighting at bantamweight, which he dropped back down to after the loss to Carl Frampton. The only defeat in that mix was to one of the pound-for-pound best, Naoya Inoue, and he looks like a world beater at 39 years old, Sergio. This is a guy, he's one of the best bantamweights of all time. And at this age, he's still showing it.
One of the greatest fighters of my generation that I'm growing up with. along with...
Well, you fought with him back in the day, right?
I did. But I'm going to say Andre Ward and Onito Donaire are the best fighters in the last 20 years in my generation. I went to the Olympic trials with them. I grew up boxing alongside him and his brother, Glenn Donaire.
What did you think of Nonito back then?
We always paid attention. Mm-hmm. There was two of my favorite fighters, even as an amateur, was Nonito Donaire, me and my trainer, by the way. Nonito Donaire and Ricardo Williams Jr., who was another he was amazing to watch. So anyway, Donaire was something just special even back then. And as a professional, what he's accomplished, you know, four division world champion, you know, that left hook. Anytime you got power like that, especially with one big punch like that, you're gonna be able to fight late into your 30s. But the fact that he's still hungry and fighting these younger champions, he's not being selective about the fighters he's fighting. He's fighting up-and-comers. He's fighting youngsters.
He wants Inoue again. Punches,
and he wants the monster again. After
that, the hell wants to get back in with that guy after a war?
Nonito Donaire, someone that's that great. That's what happens, man. Donaire is unbelievable. And he had a fan base there, too. I mean, I was there. I was freezing. It was outdoors. It was cold. But
define freezing, okay?
It was like 48 degrees. I was freezing. That's like L.A.
48
freezing.
Degrees.
But there was people around, and it was a passionate crowd. He has a fan base, a Filipino fan base. But Mexicans love him for the same reason they love Manny Pacquiao, because they get the knockout. So he has the Latino fan base, the Filipino fan base. He's an American. I mean, he's an unbelievable talent. I love watching him. The greatest fighter in the last 20 years.
People, that's high praise.
Who else?
Last 20, you mentioned Ward.
Okay.
Like Floyd, Pacquiao.
Well, look, I went to the 2000 Olympic trials. It's 2021. So I'm going to say 20 years, yes. In the last 20 years. But Mayweather, we got the second part of it.
Maybe that's still going.
Mayweather
perhaps.
Was up, you know, he turned pro, what, 96? So he's not
yeah,
really
after
my,
the 96 Olympics.
He's not really my generation. 2000, 2004, those are my Olympics. And I would say in the last 16 years, for sure, 20 years.
Of guys that are still going, he has to be right there at the top. It's remarkable how good he is. I mean, the only time he really struggled was when he moved up in weight. Every time, when he's at bantamweight, he's virtually unbeatable at that weight class. And he sounds like a guy that's able to make that weight for the foreseeable future. I mean, you mentioned Inoue, I mentioned Inoue, great fight. Love to see the rematch. But people that listen to this podcast, and you and I have talked about this as well, he told me last week he wants to drop to 115 to fight the winner of Chocolatito Estrada. Sergio, can you imagine if Chocolatito can win that fight against Estrada, which would be a tough fight for him, like in the smaller weight divisions, is there any bigger fight in the last 15, 20 years than Nonito versus Chocolatito?
That would be like Chiquita Gonzalez and Carbajal type big.
Massive.
It would be huge, especially if you really...
Something that's a Staples Center, sold out kind of fight.
It would be 20,000 people of 10,000 Mexicans and 10,000 Filipinos, and it'll be a, or whatever it is, everyone coming out, Latinos. It will be incredible. It will be incredible. Nicaraguans, that's what I'm thinking of.
Nicaraguans, yes, yeah. For Chocolatito. But Chocolatito is popular amongst Mexicans as well. Like, he's got a fan base there, too. So, I mean, that's a mega fight. I don't know if it's possible. Like, got to get Chocolatito get through his fight with Estrada first. That's going to happen, I think, in March. And then we'll see what Donaire, where his head's at. But it's a politically makeable fight because Donaire is now with ProBellum,
yeah.
Richard Schaefer. Bounce around a little bit.
Actually, that fight would do better at the Forum. Chocolatito's fought at the Forum before.
Not big enough.
The little drama show.
Yeah, but not big enough.
But it was such a...
You need 30, I mean, 20 plus thousand for that.
The atmosphere there was incredible.
It would be great, but you need 20 plus thousand for that kind of fight. That's a massive event.
That is a massive event, and it will go down in history because the style matchup, what they bring to the table, the fact that Donaire is a four-division champion, Chocolatito's a four-division world champion, they're two of the greatest of our generation. Man, historic.
I agree. All right, let's look forward to this weekend. Let's start on Saturday, where we are going to be calling the Gilberto Ramirez Yuniski Gonzalez fight. If I'm being honest, I'm not expecting a lot of resistance out of Gonzalez. He is on a 3-fight winning streak, but those 3 wins have come against very low level competition. Before that, he took 3 years off, and that was right after he got knocked out by Alexander Vodzik. That was the last of a 3-loss-in-5 fight stretch for Gonzalez. So not the highest of level of opponents. But let's just talk about Ramirez here. Since his move up to light heavyweight, What have you seen from him? We've been able to call his last couple of fights. What have you seen from Ramirez?
Well, one, he carried his power up. He's not struggling to make weight. So he's a lot happier, fresher. He looks better. And it's showing.
He said he ate a steak before the press conference
and
today.
And that's what you want to do whenever you're making weight the right way. You're not draining yourself. You're not skipping meals. You're not dehydrated. You're not moody. You actually look forward to fighting. It's the best, Mannix. It's the best as a fighter. Happy fighter is the dangerous fighter. That's a dangerous man right there. And I think, dropping weight when you're that tall, almost 6'3", dropping to 168 just to have the advantage. You were losing the advantage after you weighed in and you didn't really carry, everything you could have. So at 178, he's carrying that power, carrying that weight, eating before, not struggling, and he gets to do the easiest thing, just go out there and execute the game plan. So, no, man, I just think Ramirez, it's going to be difficult once he gets in there with a better Bivol and a Bivol and a Smith.
Well, that's the question, right?
Because those are natural light heavyweights. Yeah. And
although
Bivol
is a smaller light heavyweight.
Bivol is coming up from 168, so he's the only one. But the other ones, they're monsters that are naturally 175, and they're going to rehydrate up to closer to 200 pounds, cruiserweights when they come into that in the ring. So they're going to have that mass advantage. But Zurdo, what I like about Ramirez is the fact that he can fight in the inside for such a tall fighter. Normally, tall fighters avoid getting in the inside, That's the reason I like that tall fighter, Sebastian Fundura.
Fundura. That's this tall, and then the Sebastian Fundura.
Yeah, and then there's
right.
then there's freakish tall. But he loves
Paul
fighting
Williams-esque
in the inside.
That, yeah.
He loves with the uppercuts and the body shots. That's impressive. Paul Williams is another one. Usually tall fighters just fight on the outside. They keep it real, basic and sometimes boring. They pick you apart from the outside, and they avoid the inside for whatever reason. That's not the case for Ramirez. Zurdo's a fan-friendly fighter. Putting butts in seats, Golden Boy's promoting him the right way, and he's the next up and coming star.
All right, so what do you want to see out of him?
Knockout.
Against? Yeah, I feel like
Sullivan
Barrera
type, Sullivan Barrera type performance. Barrera was another Cuban, standout. This is another Cuban standout in their mid 30s. They've been stopped before. Go out there and get the job done quick. That's what I want. That's what I'm expecting.
Yeah, I'm feeling the same way. Now On the last thing on this topic, let's say they can make a Bivol fight. How do you see Ramirez matching up against a Bivol? Do you feel like he's on that level?
I would favor Dimitri Bivol.
Really?
In that fight? Yeah, absolutely. I would favor Bivol, but I would think Ramirez would get out of character in that fight. And I would think he has the longer arms, so if he can catch him, Bivol pulling out with a wide left hook or something. Something where he's punching with him. Bivol's a little bit too strict and won't get out of character, but Ramirez will in that second half of the fight. So it would be an entertaining, past the sixth round. I would favor Bivol, but that fight could also end in stoppage by somebody. So, yeah, I would love that fight.
All right, a few more things I want to run through. On Friday, we've got another light heavyweight title in action, two, in fact. Artur Beterbiev takes on Marcus Brown. As we record this, Sergio, I'm pretty sure that fight happens, but right now Canada is a complete shit show with the COVID-19 virus spreading all over the place. The fight is probably going to take place behind closed doors at the Bell Center. Beterbiev, undefeated, knocked out every opponent along the way. Marcus Brown, he's got that Olympic pedigree, but he's also lost to Jean Pascal, and it doesn't look like – it has not looked to this point like he's on the level of Artur Beterbiev. How do you see that fight kind of playing out?
Yeah, as soon as you talk about, all right, how do you see this fight and who do you favor, the first thing that pops up in your head is, oh, Beterbiev is going to knock him out. But anybody that knows boxing, anyone that studies the numbers, studies the opponents, studies the background, you mentioned it, U.S. Olympian, check. So he has an amateur experience. He's a tall southpaw. Check. He's going to give the lefty angles. I think the difference here that we're not seeing, the secret weapon here is going to be Derek James, the trainer.
First time working with Marcus Brown.
Exactly. The motivation is going to be there. The fact that he's going to be in camp with maybe the best southpaw in the world, and Errol Spence. He's going to pick up that southpaw information, the motivation. He's going to want to impress him as well. He has Charlo a beast. So he learns the meanness out of Charlo. So he has a good mix of three brilliant boxing minds right there in that small camp, and none of them are fighting. So he had Derrick James to himself. Derrick James concentrated however long it was, 2-3 months, just focusing on Beterbiev, who is beatable, who was overweight for this fight, might have been struggling with the weight.
Point two.
He's
point
36
two.
Years old, and I just
why do you
stylistically,
say,
man.
Why do you say Beterbiev is beatable? Now, he got knocked down by Callum Johnson. That was more of a flash knockdown for Beterbiev a couple of years ago. But why do you think he's beatable?
I just think maybe
Vodzik couldn't do it, and Vodzik is a very good fighter.
It's, you know, father time, man. I know what it's like to fight at 36 years old. I mean,
but he fights different. Like he's
a lot different. Yeah, but 36 is 36, man.
Fights different. Yes.
36 is 36, man, and that's why what Donaire is doing is incredible. And any fighter that's still in the top level past 35 is special. It really is special. This is a young man's game, and the fact that it might be time, the perfect storm might be brewing. But if there's a secret weapon here, it's the amateur pedigree, the fact that he has the experience coming from Pascal and Derrick James in his corner.
All right, so you're picking the upset.
I'm going to throw a couple hundreds on that.
You're throwing money on Marcus Brown is what you're saying.
Todd Grisham and I.
You're throwing money on Marcus Brown.
You know what? That's something that if the odds are right, yeah, why not?
Okay.
That's the type of fight where I would, absolutely. Okay. I like the underdog on that one.
Marcus had some good moments, and he beat Badu Jack, beat a few other guys.
If Todd Grisham calls me up and says, "Essay, who do you like? Marcus Brown," you know, he does my accent.
Yes.
I'm going to say, you know what? Live dog.
He does your accent like your Cheech, though. That's the
live dog, Essay. Let's take Marcus Brown, Holmes.
It's just so hard to keep Beterbiev off you, though, man.
No, it is. I mean, it's
like Vodzik was doing well in that fight. I was at that fight in Philadelphia. Vodzik was doing well for a while, and then just Beterbiev wears you down and just beats you down.
You know how tough it is to keep a monster off you for 36 minutes? 36 minutes of fighting, and you're only one punch, 1 second away from getting demolished. That's how hard he punched. I mean, no one's been able to last the distance. He has 100% knockout ratio. He's the only one in boxing with 100% knockout ratio.
Well, only champion. Virgil Ortiz also 100%.
Only champion.
Ratio. Yes.
Take
champion.
That back.
There you go. All right. Heavyweights this weekend. Joseph Parker, Derek Chisora rematch. Split decision win for Joseph Parker the last time. I like Parker to win even bigger this time. Chisora is getting older. Parker is still in his prime. His second fight, I believe, with Andy Lee as his trainer. He's training with Tyson Fury. There's a lot of boxes that Parker checks. He's got a good chin. I know he's knocked down the first round of that last fight, but that was a flash knockdown. I think Parker's the better boxer, and I think Chisora, as he has done over the last few years, has a very good first 3 or 4 rounds and then fades. I haven't seen anything Sergio and Derek Chisora that tells me all of a sudden he's going to be in the kind of shape that's going to make him a threat in rounds 8 through 12. That's been his Achilles heel in recent years. He's been really good early and then fades late. How do you see that fight?
I see this fight being a lot better for Parker. He knows what to expect. He was keeping his head up a little bit too high. He was fighting too tall. The jab was a little lazy. He got knocked down in the first round, I believe, right, in that fight?
That's what I said, yeah, first round. Yeah.
Okay, so anytime he gets dropped I tune out when you're talking.
All right, cool.
But anytime a fighter gets knocked down that early, he stops worrying about the game plan and just starts worrying about winning rounds and not getting hit like that again. So the game plan got thrown out really early in that fight. For this fight, he knows what to expect. He already felt the power. He probably got shocked by the fact that Chisora was able to close the distance that fast for being a big guy. Yeah, it's going to be a different fight. With a snappy jab, keeping the distance, keeping that chin down, which is most important for Joseph Parker, and letting go of that right hand at the right time in the second half of the fight, I could see him hurting Chisora. Maybe not knocking him out, but hurting him where the corner has to maybe look into it, the doctor, maybe even the referee.
Well, he can knock him out. I mean, Chisora is very knockoutable.
I don't think with one punch. It's going to be an accumulation of right hands and jabs and stuff like that. It won't be a one-punch knockout. Parker's not that eraser type. So someone's going to have to get involved, but Chisora might be a little one too many wars. So
he's been a lot of wars. He has no intention of retiring anytime
soon. They call
either.
Him war.
Well, he's kind of adopted that in recent years. He was Del Boy for a long time. Now he's War Chisora. He's a fun fighter. He, to me, though, is a gatekeeper at this point. And look, as he said to us before, we've called some of his fights, he's not a championship fighter. He's a money weight fighter. He fights for cash at this point. So he draws fans. He'll be the crowd favorite over in the UK. I just don't see the skill set.
He's a
there
prize
anymore.
Fighter. And I think he got.
Did you see him at the press conference when he had the piece of tape over his mouth?
Yeah.
Saying, Eddie, pay me to talk.
Listen, I don't
that
get
was great.
It, he busted that, I believe it's Marilyn Monroe says, I don't get up out of bed at least for $2,000.
Remember he did that to Prograde Taylor before their fight. He said, why? I'm not fighting unless you pay me more money or make me the main event. These guys are trying to make money off of me. I'm not a champion, but I'm the draw. That's what it is. That's what real power is in boxing, right? Like your ability to draw fans, draw viewers, and that's what Chisora, even at this stage, still does.
You know, and he has this persona. You know, he walks in with that, with the British flag around his face, the UK flag around his face, and he's a big guy too. You know, I've seen him in person. He's a big guy. He has this wide shoulders. He looks like a bad guy in a movie, and he always has that demeanor. So yeah, everyone likes the bad guy, and he plays it up,
Yeah, I think he gets knocked out. I think Parker has enough in him to stop him in the later rounds, and Chisora has been knocked out a few times before in the past. So I think that's how that fight
war. War Chisora.
It'll be war. I don't need to talk about Jake Paul, Tyron Woodley. I will say
Well, then don't.
I'm not going to talk about the
fight. Why you bring it up?
I'm not talking because
I'm tired of talking about it.
It's an event.
No, it's an event that no one that really cares about boxing
cares about. That's dumb. That's not true. People that care about boxing are watching other boxers on that card. Amanda Serrano is on that card. She's fighting at lightweight.
Who's she fighting?
Miriam Gonzalez. I want to say I'm blanking on her last
name.
Amanda Serrano is the draw there. This is where we disagree. Jake Paul is not going to win a world championship. He's not going to become a, quote, real boxer. But Jake Paul is drawing attention for other real boxers. Sergio, I'll be the first
attention.
To admit. I'll admit.
We're in it for attention now.
Of course, we just talked about what the power of being a draw. Like, of course you're in it for attention one way or the other. I didn't know who Montana Love was before he fought on the undercard of Jake Paul. He fought Ivan Baranchuk. He knocked him out. Now, I know who he is. And way more importantly, he got a multi-fight deal from Matchroom.
But it wasn't because he was on that undercard.
Of course
it was because
it was.
He knocked out a tough guy in Baranchuk who was in a fight of the year.
A fight
and the
made.
Way he did it with that big right hand, he knocked out a tough guy.
It's
that's
a
what
fight
people remember.
Never,
not the fact that he was on an undercard of some Joe Schmo.
It's a fight he never would have gotten if he didn't fight in the Jake Paul undercard. It's a fight that got the exposure it got because it was on the Jake Paul undercard. You ask Eddie Hearn. Eddie Hearn probably didn't know who Montana Love was before that last fight.
Do you have Jake Paul's phone number?
I do not.
Why are you talking about Jake Paul so much? Are you on the inside? Are you getting
Yes, I'm getting
up?
I'm getting YouTube views.
Yeah, you're getting YouTube money here?
Yes.
I mean, I don't even know why
How do you
you're
not
mentioning
have a YouTube
this guy
page at this point.
I don't know why you're Backyard mentioning this man's name. I mean, I'm going to tell you, I respect what he's doing as a businessman,
correct,
as a young man and making millions of dollars being an a-hole. Good for him. I respect his hustle. I'm not going to knock it, but I'm a boxer. I've dedicated my entire life doing this. I know boxing lifers. I know what it takes to be a part of this, the blood we spilled. And to see this guy come in there and make more money than guys that have been doing all their lives, it's a spit in the face, a slap in the face. I don't want it.
Yeah,
I don't want to see it. I don't care if he brings any kind of younger viewership. They're only going to watch him. Then I watch the undercard. So it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I don't care.
Okay. That's
see,
where
now
you're
you got
wrong.
Me pissed
no,
off.
That's where you're wrong. People watched Montana Love. Eddie Hearn signed Montana Love because of that performance.
He knocked him out because of the knockout, because of the performance, not because of the eyes that he brought to the table, because of the people watching.
Amanda Serrano is going to be the co-main event on a visible card for the second fight in a row. You can't deny that Amanda Serrano against Katie Taylor is a bigger fight because of Jake Paul. You can't deny that.
No, it's going to be bigger because she's fighting the best fighter in the world. In women's sports,
okay.
And that's Katie Taylor.
Katie didn't look that good in the last fight.
No, she didn't, but she's still pound for pound number one.
I agree.
That's the reason Serrano and her will
yes,
be a big
but
fight.
But Jake Paul has increased the visibility for Amanda Serrano. You don't think so?
Says you. I don't know.
What was Amanda Serrano fighting on before this? She fought on NBC Sports Network in the fight before that. Nobody watched that.
Nobody watched it, but you got to give credit to where it's due. One, she's a bad fighter, like damn
I
good.
I do, but that's not the point.
If it wasn't for Katie Taylor, she would be number one. I'll be honest with you. Not Clarissa Shields.
I
watched Clarissa.
Sure, fine. I don't.
I watched Clarissa Shields and Amanda Serrano. Serrano's
I don't dispute that. I don't dispute that. But you need visibility in boxing. You know that. You got. How did you become a star? You won the damn contender in front of 10 million people.
11 million people.
11 million. This is what I'm talking about. Jake Paul increased the visibility. By the way, if Jake Paul, which he will be, involved in the Serrano versus Taylor fight, he's going to bring the fucking problem bot out to New York and have that at the press conference. And it's going to make it bigger. It's going to make it bigger. I'm telling you. Maybe it'll be a Mrs. Problem Bot for that fight. Like, there's an idea.
Dude, you're such a nerd.
I think it's fun. I think Jake Paul's fun. And by the way,
you're attracted by YouTube hits and a robot.
Okay, Jake Paul fought an eight round fight against Tyron Woodley in his last fight. I have seen 100 shittier world title fights than that. Like, that's not bad boxing. Lamar Odom versus Aaron Carter is bad boxing. This is not bad boxing. It's not great, but it's not bad boxing.
My barbecue fighting days were a lot more better than that. And I didn't even know how to box. I wasn't training with professional fighters. I didn't have all the money this man spends on trying to become a better boxer. I just knew how to fight because I knew how to fight. I was born with it. This guy,
he takes it seriously, though. He works with my old friend, BJ Flores. Works with guys.
I'll give him that. He takes it serious.
He does. So what do you want him to do?
Fight a real fighter.
You want to fight a cruiserweight? You want to fight some
Joe Schmo?
Fight
a real fighter. Fight a guy that's a 50-50 record. Then you'll get my attention. Anybody. Fight a loser. Fight someone that hasn't
watch that.
As long as he fights a professional fighter, then I'll give him credit.
Nobody will watch that.
I don't care.
Tommy Fury's a professional fighter. Do you care about that?
Okay. Look, Tyson Fury.
Tommy.
Tyson Fury's younger, nephew?
It's his half-brother.
Whatever he is. He has that Fury last name. He's undefeated against nobody's. At least he could say he was a professional fighter. At least, and he has that Fury last name. So that would have been attractive.
You last fight for Tommy
Fury? I would have been all
for it. Terrible.
I would have been all for it for it. But the fact that he's fighting basketball players and football players, and no, man, come on. What's next? Sports Illustrated writers?
For the right price, I'll get back in the ring.
I bet you will.
Yeah.
I will love Jake
Paul. I went three rounds with Juan Manuel Marquez.
That's
world
the story of your life.
126.
We're going to the Soho House or what?
We're not going to the Soho House.
This is the only reason I did this podcast.
It's not true. We're not going to the Soho House. We're going to the Riverwalk. We're not going to the Soho House. All right, last thing. I reported today, Daniel Jacobs back in February in London. He's going to take on John Ryder. This is part of a plan for Team Jacobs to get him back on top. Hopefully, if things go right for Jacobs, he fights Joe Smith for a light heavyweight title in the middle of next year. And hopefully, if he wins that fight, he gets a matchup with Golovkin, Canelo, another rematch that he badly wants. Jacobs has been successful, but he really hasn't been entertaining. I mean, not since he starched you a couple of times has he been an entertaining fighter, really. Do you think that Jacobs, after being off since November of 2020, can get back on top?
He starched me in that second fight when I was inactive on one foot and I was already 36 years old. In that first fight, I was ready to go.
My favorite clip.
And Daniel Jacobs is, 35 years old?
Mid-30s.
Yeah, he was the exact same age I was when I fought him. And I
Ask you this. The fight against Rosado, which was the most uninspired win I've ever seen. Like, what did you see in that?
It wasn't a win.
Well, whatever. I thought he won, but big deal. He draw, whatever you want to call it.
He was vulnerable. He was unmotivated. It wasn't him. He wasn't going for the knockout. Normally, he has a big right hand. He has confidence. He has swag. He brings that Brooklyn, bravado. He had none of that. And I questioned, not only his heart, his training, where his mindset is at, but why didn't he have Andre Rozier in his corner, the man that got him there in the first place? So Andre's back. Yes. So that's a good plus. The fact that, he has that bad performance against Rosado, the fact that he's a former champion and knows that he still has the ability and that hunger. And if Canelo, we know who the man is at 168, he cleaned out the division. But Jacobs, I can see him beating Saunders. I can see him beating Caleb Plant. I can see him beating or being a hell of a fight with Benavidez. I mean, it's a great division,
so
and Daniel Jacobs is right in the middle of it.
So you believe that he can, like, he looked to me like a fighter that lost the fire in his belly against Rosado. And even though I hate you and all you stand for, you've taught me a lot over the years about kind of what that means, right? Like, from the contender, where you talked about how you lost some of that after that. From the first win over Forrest to the second fight where you partied too much and, went out of, got a little out of control, you've taught me a lot about kind of that, the ebb and flow of a fighter. You saw what he was against Rosado. Do you think he can get that fire back? Because that, to me, is the most important thing. He's still got the skills, but can he get the fire to be a world champion, to be a top-level guy back?
You know, whenever you have that overnight success and you may have that life-changing money and you have the attention, you get the spoils of victory, and that's what every fighter, I don't care who you talk to, Mannix, every fighter wants that, and when they have it, they indulge in it, but they also got to, they have to know how to balance both of them, and that's where I kind of leaned too much with the indulgence. But Daniel Jacobs, it had nothing to do with indulgence. It was just maybe... That was a lot. How much money did he make?
Shout out Keith Conley. No. He's made a lot of money over the years.
Tens of millions, right?
Tens of millions.
I'm talking about Canelo, Golovkin.
Comeback fights. Like, you know.
Tens of millions of dollars. All right. So, yeah, shout out to Keith Conley. But that changes a fighter. Whenever you grow up with nothing in the streets of Brooklyn, streets of East L.A., you know, that's all you want. And when finally you have it, you know, you lose a little bit of that hunger. It's cliche, it's cheesy, but you lose that hunger. And you get it back. The way you get it back is not going broke. You get it back by naysayers, people counting you out, people turning their back on you, people saying that you don't have it no more. That's what brings your fire back. Not the money, because you have it already. It's the fact that everyone doubts you, no one thinks you could do it again, and you just want to challenge yourself. And when you look at yourself in the mirror and you see, okay, can you do it? Yes, I can. Let's do it then. Get your ass back up on the ball. Let's get this title again. That's what I had when I fought him that first time. You know, I had that eye of the tiger. Oh, shit, man. I really thought I was going to be a two-time champion. And then, obviously, my ankle, you know, busted. But,
you know, Jacob's fist, you know.
He's a hard puncher. He's the biggest middleweight I've ever been in the ring.
Huge middleweight.
One of the hardest punchers I've been in there with. And, yeah, if he comes back hungry, he's going to be a force to reckon with that super middleweight.
If he doesn't, though, he loses to John Ryder. Like, John Ryder's a
John Ryder can make a big fighter look.
And he's fighting that fight in the UK. Average. He's going to fight in London. Yeah. So,
like, he's going to have to hurt Ryder, or else if that fight goes into the later rounds, I see Ryder pulling that off.
And Ryder,
just in an ugly, sloppy fight.
He may have gotten robbed against Callum
Smith.
And he's won two fights in a row since then.
Yep. No, it's a bad style matchup. So if Jacobs doesn't come in there taking Ryder seriously, he's not going to have the fans on his side. He's not going to have the judges on his side. He's going to have nobody on his side, just his talent and his corner. So, you know, he's going to be out on his P's and Q's.
Yeah, it's win or go home for Daniel Jacobs. All right, you want to go to the bar?
Please.
Can you? That belt is ridiculous.
Hey, wait a minute. What? We're not going to the Soho House?
We're not going to the Soho House. We talked about this. It's an hour and a half away.
Waffle House, then.
Cut it. When we come back, my conversation with Darren Williams. With big fights every week, there's never been a better time to give FanDuel Sportsbook a shot and join the action on FanDuel Fight Nights. Because right now, you can place your first bet risk-free. That's right, you get up to $1,000 back if you don't win. FanDuel gives you so many bets to choose from. There are parlays, round props, method of victory bets, and so much more. My best bet this weekend, Marcus Brown to defeat Artur Beterbiev. I'm a little leery on Brown, who I don't know if he's on Beterbiev's level, but Beterbiev has not looked great lately. Marcus Brown has a new trainer. Feels like the kind of fight Marcus Brown might be able to pull off. Take Marcus Brown to beat Artur Beterbiev. Offers like this are just one of the many reasons I love betting on FanDuel. It is the number one rated sportsbook app in America. It's easy to use. There are safe and secure payouts. The app, incredibly easy. When you win, you'll get paid in as little as 2 hours. With FanDuel in your corner, you'll always get exclusive odds boosts, great promotions, and so much more to make your FanDuel fight night even more exciting. That's why they're America's number one sportsbook. Sign up with the promo code BOXING to bet risk-free up to $1,000 on FanDuel Sportsbook. Download FanDuel today. That's promo code BOXING. So Darren, I guess start by kind of walk me through how a former NBA All-Star, 12-year NBA veteran, winds up getting involved in a professional boxing match.
Where do I start? I got a call about 6 weeks ago saying that Frank Gore was looking for an opponent, and I was like, why not? But before that, you know, I've been training MMA for quite some time now. I'm part owner of an MMA gym in Dallas, Fortis MMA. And, you know, I grew up, my first sport was wrestling, wrestled for 9 years. So I've just kind of always loved combat sports. I've always been a boxing fan, an MMA fan. And so when the opportunity came about, you know, I kind of jumped on it.
So before 6 weeks ago, had you given any real thought to doing something like this?
Yeah, I had already, I actually was training for a fight right before COVID, and that was supposed to happen in February. And the guy backed out, and then obviously COVID happened in March, and didn't give much thought to it, you know, after that, because we were all, everybody was sitting at home for, you know, a year. And then, you know, as of this last year, with you know, the Paul brothers and this, you know, Ocho Cinco and guys like that getting in the ring, you know, I watched and I was like, shoot, that'd be kind of fun. You know, it's kind of something that I've always wanted to do. And when I was approached about it, I like I said, I jumped on it because I feel like, you know, it's one of those opportunities that if I passed on, I'd be kicking myself for.
So why go back to February of 2020? Why did you want to do it then? I mean, you've spent your entire life, you know, hours, countless hours trained to be a professional basketball player.
Mm-hmm.
Boxing, no matter how much you kind of work at combat sports, it's a different animal, as we've seen with, you know, guys kind of venturing into the sport mm-hmm. in the past. What made you confident that you could succeed in it?
Well, I'm not trying to be a world champion boxer. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not trying to make a career of this. I'm not trying, that's not what I'm doing here, you know. You know, I'm coming in to check a box, you know, do something that I want to do, that I love doing. And I think that's the main reason for me.
So February of 2020 kind of predated what we saw from Nate Robinson, predated what we saw from Lamar Odom.
Mm-hmm.
When you watch kind of those guys stumble through it to a degree,
mm-hmm.
What did you think?
Well, Lamar Odom, that thing was, I don't even know what that was.
That's still going on, Darren. Like, he's still doing it.
That was embarrassing is what that was. He fought a dude that was like 150 pounds less than him and still got, he got a couple good punches. If he didn't have the headgear on, he might have been out.
Mm.
And then Nate, I think, you know, I give Nate props because he, you know, he got in there and really did it. I don't think he was prepared. I don't think he knew quite how serious Jake Paul was, you know, taking the sport of boxing. I think he thought, you know, I'm one of the best athletes in the world because Nate Robinson is one of the best athletes that I've ever seen personally, and thought that he could go in there and use that. But that's not going to work in boxing. And so I know that I'm very aware of that, and that it takes a unique skill set to box. And so you know, I'm definitely not taking Frank Gore lightly. I'm not overlooking him. I know that he's an extremely tough athlete, a very talented athlete. And I know he's a hard worker, and he's been, you know, he's been boxing for years. You know, he's been doing it as a form of a training. And so, you know, I'm very aware of that.
I heard it took Frank Gore some convincing of Frank Gore to get in the ring with you.
You know, I don't know what, I don't listen to hearsay, you know, and it doesn't,
just behind the scenes stuff, Darren, a little Showtime chatter.
It doesn't really matter. You know, I mean, it's a scary thing to get in the ring. You know, I think it's not for everybody. You know, people are asking me, why are you doing it? Now I've had people like, what are you thinking? Like, what, like, well, I'm doing it 'cause I want to do it. I feel like I want to do this, you know? And yeah, it's scary. I'm sure I'll be nervous. But I think it'll be fun too. I think it'll be, you know, a unique experience that not a lot of people get a chance to do, especially in front of, you know, a crowd and the world.
So when did you kind of, and how did you make the transition from MMA training to boxing training, and how difficult was that transition to make?
Well, I mean, a lot of MMA is boxing, you know, it's boxing based. And, you know, there's days where we just spar you know, only boxing. And so it's something that I've been familiar with, I've been comfortable with. But now I really just turned that focus to only boxing. You know, there was no jujitsu, there was no wrestling, there was no kicking, there was nothing, you know, and I took a different approach to it. And, you know, I had some injuries over the last year that kind of kept me from doing jujitsu and things. And so I was kind of strictly working on my boxing, working on my stand up. So it was kind of like the right timing, I feel like, to where I could just, you know, just focus on that. And it's for me, it's a lot easier at my age to get ready for a boxing match than it is to get ready for, you know, an MMA match.
So what, you said you're not trying to become a world champion.
No.
What are you trying to get out of this? Do you look at this as one and done?
Yeah, just, or... I mean, that's how I'm approaching it. You know, I'm 37 years old. Like I said, this is like a box I wanted to check. You know, I wanted to fight in some way, shape or form. You know, originally I didn't think boxing was a way to do it because there wasn't really this celebrity boxing thing wasn't really a thing until the last, you know, year and a half, 2 years when the Paul brothers kind of made it popular. And so, you know, I'm just looking at it as I'm fighting Frank Gore on December 18th, and then you probably won't hear from me for a while again.
I don't believe that, because if you look great against Frank Gore, someone's going to say, like, let's see Darren Williams against somebody else. Are you really going to turn that down?
That's a lot, man. This is a lot of training. It's a lot of time. You know, honestly, this, like, I had been saying I want to do it, and everything came together, like, at the right time, honestly. I would have liked to have a little more notice, you know, because I got the notice at 6 weeks. I would have liked to have a little longer camp. But also, I actually feel like it was kind of good because it's just like it's already here, you know. And so, but like my daughter, she's just now about to start volleyball, and she's playing every week club volleyball, and so it's just like I'm not gonna miss her stuff, you know, so that I can just focus on a whole nother profession. It's just not gonna happen. And so, you know, for me, I am taking this as a one off, and we'll see what happens, you know. Like you said, I mean, I never know until I get in there and see what happens. But, you know, this was just a one-time thing that I wanted to do. Gave me a reason to get back in shape and, you know, have a chance to fight, because I've always wanted to fight.
You have been kind of quiet. People haven't heard much from you since you retired back in 2017. I mean, how have you been spending the last 4+ years?
Yeah, I've just been, I was, you know, doing a lot of MMA training, a lot of golfing. Over the last like 2 years, I haven't done much golfing, building some houses, you know, doing some, so I got some side businesses here and there, got the MMA gym, Fortis MMA. And so, that's kind of it. I'm quiet. I don't really do much homebody. Like to hang out with my family.
Going back to 2017, like, how did you know that was time, that it was, you were only 33 years old when you retire from the NBA? How did you know that was time?
I mean, it was, honestly, I feel like I left a little early, but there was a lot of factors that went into that. It wasn't just, you know, one thing. You know, mentally, I just wasn't in a good place, which was a lot of it, I think, and didn't really love how, you know, that season ended for me and where I was at, and injuries. I feel like there hadn't been a season where I could just stay healthy and not get injured. And so I didn't know if I could take another season of that, you know, of that disappointment. And so just I never formally retired, I guess, you know, but it was kind of one of those things where as time went on, it was like, all right, it's definitely too late now. These boys ain't playing, you know, and I'm not stupid to think I could just, after 3 years of just not playing basketball, I'd be like, oh yeah, let me just go hop back in there with these young fellas, you know? So that is kind of how it ended.
The physical stuff. I mean, there's actually a website devoted to your injuries during your NBA career. Like, it is a long, long list of injuries, Darren. You've dealt with a lot. Like, when you look at all the injuries you had to battle through, what was the one or ones that you thought robbed you the most?
You know, it's funny because, like, I never had like the horrible, you know, I never had an ACL or anything like that, you know, knock on wood, that like just hit me hard. It was just always like nagging little stupid injuries. And probably my ankles were the worst, I think, because I waited so long to get them repaired. And they just like, they took a lot out of me. It was, you know, my first couple of years in Brooklyn. And I just had no lift. My ankles would swell up like softballs after games. I couldn't walk up, you know, I lived in a two-story apartment in New York. Couldn't walk up the stairs. Couldn't like go run around the park with my kids. Just, they were, you know, little at the time. I couldn't do the normal things that I wanted to. And that definitely took a lot out of me, a lot of my confidence. And then, you know, on top of that, having to deal with, you know, the pressure of being, you know, supposed to be the franchise guy and you're not performing, you know. And it wasn't the outside pressure, it was the pressure that I personally put on myself, because, you know, I wanted to be better.
Was that what you felt derailed that first year in Brooklyn? I mean, in my basement, I have the cover story for Sports Illustrated that I wrote with all five of you guys on the cover saying, yeah, who wants a piece of them? Yeah. And at the time, it looked like, you know, you guys were poised to win the whole thing. Like, how much did that internal pressure, you know, kind of affect you and how that season unraveled?
I think it was more injuries, you know. I started out that season where I didn't even, I was hurt to start the season. My ankles were hurt before. I was actually in a boot for most of the, like, camp and before the season. And Brooke Lopez ended up breaking his foot. Paul ended up getting hurt, missing games. You know, KG was battling through all type of stuff, you know. And so we didn't really get a chance to, like, have everybody at once. We didn't get a chance to click. You know, J-Kid was his first year coaching, you know, had the situation with him and Lawrence Frank. There was just a lot of stuff going on, I think, at one time. And it was kind of just like a shit storm. And didn't go well, but we battled back the second half of the season and still, you know, lost to a tough LeBron and D-Wade, Chris Bosh Miami team.
Do you think health would have changed anything with that team, or was that team kind of snake bitten for different reasons?
I think so. I think for sure. You know, you add some different health and different luck, you know, little things here and there. I think for sure it's a different team.
When you and Chris Paul for so many years were connected, intertwined as two top picks in that draft, when you watch him kind of play right now, kind of nearing 40 and still kind of going, do you think at all, like, if injuries hadn't robbed me of certain things, that could be you still out there? What do you think of when you watch a Chris Paul?
I mean, that's hard to say, because I mean, who else from that draft class is doing that?
Yeah.
Right. That's not what he's doing. That's not normal. That's not easy. You know, that's not to be taken lightly. He's doing that because he's doing that, you know, and I'm really good friends with Chris and had a chance to talk with him. And, you know, I'm so impressed. I've always been impressed with his career, you know, and him as a player, as a person. But yeah, I'm really impressed with what he's done these last 2-3 years, because, you know, he was having injury problems, you know, when he was in Houston and before that, you know, where he was missing playoffs and people were writing him off, and then he got the big contract and people were like, that's a stupid contract. Mm-hmm. Well, he's proven that it's not a stupid contract, and that he's still an elite point guard, one of the best to do it. So
it's funny how quickly that changes, right? Like, it went from being a terrible contract to now he's going to make even more money in the next deal. Like, yeah. It's just on a dime. Did you think that you were going to be able to kind of get what you lost back in Dallas when you went down there after leaving Brooklyn?
Money wise, or
no? I mean, like, your game back, kind of like rediscover yourself there.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. But I still dealt with the same injuries, you know, then. And that was the frustrating thing. But Dallas was definitely a better situation for me personally, I think. And you know, I'm definitely very thankful for that organization. Love playing for that organization. And you know, I hoped it would have went a little bit better, but you know, they were kind of at a point where it was time for them to rebuild. And so, you know, the situation ended a little early.
All right. Before I let you go, you said that this for now is a one-off against Frank Gore on December 18th. If there's anyone in your NBA playing days, past or playing right now, that you could get in the ring with? I'm sure you've been asked this question before, but I'm going to ask it again. That you get in the ring with, who would it be?
I don't even know, man. Paul Pierce just asked me this question a couple days ago.
I thought it would be Paul Pierce.
So I almost thought about saying that to him just to mess with him. But I don't have a problem with Paul. I mean, and I get what he was saying, you know. This stuff doesn't bother me, man. I'm too old to get bothered by little stuff like that.
Did it bother you at the time when he was kind of saying like he expected you and some of the younger guys to step forward and you didn't? Did that bother you at the time?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. Yeah, for sure it did. But at the same time, he was kind of right. So it's like, what do you say? I was the franchise guy. I was a max player. You know, it was my job, and I wasn't able to do it. So as much as it, you know, it hurts or it hurt, there's truth to it. So it can't hurt that much, you know. You know, it's funny, like, and he knows this, but there was one guy that I did not like when I was in the NBA. Well, there was a couple guys, but I used to get into it with was Dante Jones.
Ah.
Couldn't stand him because he always tripped me, always play. I mean, play hard D, always tripped me. Like, you know, was one of those guys that tried to get under your skin. And I would have said him until I played with him in Cleveland. And he became my boy, and I love Dante. But before that, it was probably him.
That's a good one. That's a good one. Yeah. What about, I have two names. I mentioned Pierce. Carlos Boozer.
Mm-hmm.
Would you want to fight him?
Why would I want to fight Booze? That's my.
I don't know. He's your teammate. Like an ex-teammate. You know, yeah, you know, I don't know.
That's my boy. Why would I want to fight him?
I don't know.
Booze is a big boy, man. Booze is like 280, man.
He is a big boy. I got one other, and I'm sure you'll say no to this because I wouldn't want to fight him either. David West. That seems like a guy, like he was boxing even before.
Was he?
He's a boxer for a long time.
Was he? Yeah, I didn't even know that. But I mean, you're talking guys that have like 40, you know, pounds on me, and probably a good 6, 7, 8 inches of reach advantage.
You're an inside guy, Darren. Like, you know, you went from being an outside guy in basketball.
Okay, here's the thing. If boxing, probably no. MMA, 100%, either one of them.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you're clearly adept at that. Like, I've seen athletes try to do MMA. I've seen boxers. I was at the James Toney fight years ago.
Yeah.
When he tried MMA. That didn't go well.
No.
That's a very different sport.
Very different.
Well, Darren, good luck, man. December 18th on Showtime pay-per-view, Darren Williams, Frank Gore. And I'm just going to tell you, Darren, I don't think this is going to be a one-off for you. If you're successful, I think there's a multi-fight thing that's going to happen here.
Well, we'll see. We'll see about that, but I don't know about that, buddy.
Good to talk to you, man.
All right, you too.
That's it for this week's episode. My thanks to Sergio Mora and Darren Williams for joining the show. As always, subscribe, rate, review this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, anywhere you download podcasts, and we'll see you next week.